having peacekeepers that can actually peace the keep is good.
Peace the keep? Oh.
Keep the peace. I'm being distracted.
Or not water vapor. I'm reading a style on water vapor while saying this. Okay. Replace those. We're going to burn water vapor. Welcome back to the Morning Update Podcast. Today we're going to go over the COP 28. Was it COP 28 or COP 29?
I think it's COP 29.
COP 29. Okay. The COP 29 deal, which is, if you don't know, it's like a climate conference. And we thought it'd be really interesting to go over what we think about all this environmentalist stuff, because we have different opinions on it, and also what they went over and what the key takeaways are from it and what we should implement in the United States as sort of like an opinionated way. So yeah, let's get into that. And before we start, I think it's pretty important to talk about Saudi Arabia, because they're kind of like they're the thorn in the COP conference's side. I mean, every single time they come up with a deal of like, hey, let's get rid of fossil fuels, Saudi Arabia does something to get rid of it or change it or do something like that. And there was no, they did it again this time. They're going to do it every single time.
Really see like this COP 29 is being hosted in Baku, which back in like 1910 produced like half of the world's oil, and prominent members of this conference are Russia, China, Saudi Arabia. I mean, at least tangentially, they are involved, but their involvement is purely to sabotage the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of silly.
The Western world is all like, yeah, let's, you know, do this and this and that and stop using natural gas and coal and things like that. And then there'll be China, which builds like what, a coal factory a week? It's something incredible. I don't know how they do it. They build an insane number of dirty coal plants and things like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so let's get into some quick current events backstory of Saudi Arabia. Talk about a deal that the United States kind of wanted to do with Saudi Arabia. So what's really interesting is the westernization of the peninsula. I mean, not too long ago, they were kind of they're more unfriendly to the United States than they are now. Like right now, they're kind of like a Western nation, but they're in the Middle East, if that makes sense. And they're Islamic, but that doesn't really matter too much. And I find that,
from what I've heard, there are a great many people who, even though they will kind of claim to live out this Islamic lifestyle, will try to live out this very secular Western lifestyle. And you see that in these super rich Gulf countries.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Saudi Arabia is building this ginormous, they have so many cities going on right now. They have this project called NEOM, and it's like they're building like what, 10 different cities? Each one's supposed to hold like at least 1 million people, and they're incredibly futuristic. They look Western, but futuristic type Western, different types of designs and things like that. And I find that pretty interesting. It's because like they're stuck on like in between worlds. They got the Western world, they have the money, they have the economy, but they're Islamic, so they also have like the Middle Eastern type culture too. And so it's interesting, and it leads to an interesting nation as a whole. I mean,
well, I think a lot of these mega projects, like there was also that city that was supposed to be like 100 miles long, cutting in a big gash across the desert.
Yeah.
I think it's really they're trying to create something lasting, because even if I think the basic math is that oil isn't a very renewable resource, and that even if we find a way to synthesize oil out of corn, that's not going to grow in the desert. So these nations' supplies aren't going to last forever. So they're trying to find something that can make people want to stay there after they're all out of oil.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So the recent, I don't know if you want to call it a dilemma, but the recent event was, we have this sort of defense treaty that we had going with Saudi Arabia. It wasn't official, nothing was signed, but it was pretty expected that eventually the United States and Saudi Arabia would come together, they'd sign a treaty, and it would kind of formalize our relationship and formalize Saudi Arabia as a more Western country than an Islamic country. And that's not going to happen anymore, which is really interesting.
Related to the Abraham Accords?
I believe so, yeah. I think it was, yeah, because under Trump wanted to have this treaty with Saudi Arabia, and it included Israel too, but yeah.
And why do you think they're backing out now?
I'm not sure. It's kind of weird because I don't 100% know. They're Saudi Arabia, but I would think it's because that they have more pressure because the war in Rafah, well, not Rafah anymore, but the war that Israel is doing in Gaza and Lebanon, or was doing in Lebanon, and the kind of like pressure from other Islamic countries, but I'm not 100% certain.
Yeah, and I mean they would probably be under a good deal of pressure to conform with all of these nations in the Middle East that are, at least on the surface, fiercely against what Israel is doing. It could also be that they're trying to, just like how Trump is putting up these massive tariff numbers, to kind of have a high bar for negotiation. Maybe they're trying to do that with negotiating with the U.S. Tried backing out of the deal a little bit to see if they can get more out of the final deal.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah. I mean, that would make sense because Trump would likely, I mean, it sounds weird saying it because Trump tends to be more of a strongman on foreign policy, but I could see Trump trying to give Saudi Arabia more to finalize their relationship. Kind of like how Biden will give more to less friendly countries like Iran to finalize some sort of American-Iranian re relationship. I could see Trump doing the same, but with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
But I don't know, because I don't see any way that they could get more from Biden. There just isn't enough time. The
No.
transition is pretty well through already.
And I don't trust Biden to do anything very good in this next month. It is
Yeah.
interesting to see. So it's an oversimplification, but the Saudis need Israel to recognize Palestine before there's a U.S.-Saudi alliance.
No, that's, yeah.
And then the Americans are like, well, the Saudis have to recognize Israel for this alliance to happen. So do we both give way, and then we would end up alienating Israel a little bit, maybe a lot, but we would get the Saudis as an ally. Is that worth it? Is it
Well, that's.
possible to have our cake and eat it too?
I think so, because that's the interesting part. I heard did like a tiny little bit of research a long time ago on Saudi's prerequisites for a deal with Israel, and they didn't technically say I'm going to act like a lawyer, but they didn't technically say Israel had to recognize Palestine. They said that Israel has to say that they will consider recognizing Palestine at some point in the future. So all Israel has to say is fine, we'll put it up in our parliament at some time and be like, sure, we'll consider it. They don't have to pass anything or say, yeah, we recognize Palestine.
So it could definitely be just kind of a measure to save face and say, hey, we tried to get Israel to moderate.
Yeah, under the current Saudi re leadership, I think they
Sure.
are definitely leaning more towards Western than Islamic.
And to
And yeah.
get them as an ally, I think that would be pretty beneficial to have a country aligned against Iran, a country that, like, it's very close to the shoot, is it the Houthis in Yemen that are causing all this trouble in the Red Sea? They could help us with that.
That would be really great because they at least have, you know, somewhat of a navy, and they have so does Saudi Arabia have Western missiles?
From the US, yes.
Okay, yeah, so they could certainly help us out. That'd be great.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it was Saudi Arabia that was the staging ground for the liberation of Kuwait.
Okay.
It worked with
Okay,
them
yeah.
before.
That would work really well into Trump's more foreign policy plan, because the way I see it, Trump's foreign policy plan is similar to Reagan, but instead of using America's might all the way around the globe, it's we're going to use America's might at home and in the Pacific because that's where we need it. But we're going to build alliances and strengthen the ones we have to essentially strengthen America's might, like build up NATO more by making countries pay their fair share so that they have a stronger military to defend from Russia so we don't have to do as much. And that could be the same thing with Saudi Arabia. Strengthen Saudi Arabia, arm them, things like that. That way we don't have to do as much in the Middle East.
I think that would be a very beneficial alliance to get. I mean, we would have to be cautious about it because we don't want to get more tangled in alliances. We don't want to spend years complaining about all this foreign intervention and then get into more foreign intervention.
Yeah.
But something that can guarantee a more peaceful order in the Middle East, it's not going to take much for that to be achieved with how low the bar is right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that hard to at least make it somewhat more peaceful at this point, just because it's so crazy.
Speaking of peace in the Middle East, ceasefire in Lebanon, Israeli troops pulling out of southern Lebanon. They seem to have had massive success with destroying Hezbollah where they found it, but now it seems like the war is just going back to status quo. What do you think has been achieved here?
Quite a bit. We'll see how effective the Lebanese army and the UN peacekeepers are, because they're supposed to remove Hezbollah if they don't remove themselves from the buffer zone and then maintain the buffer zone. And that was supposed to happen in 2006 as well, but it didn't. Hezbollah was not maintained. They went into the buffer zone. They continually attacked Israel. So I think it's
Hopefully,
gonna, yeah.
this time there will actually be a meaningful peacekeeping force that doesn't allow terrorists to set up shop on the border.
Right. Yeah. The one fear I have is from the UNRWA disaster. I mean, you have UN members and employees who are part of a relief branch of the UN. Like they give aid and relief to people, to citizens, and they're actively working for Hamas, and some of them even participated in October 7th. That's the only fear I have, is that the peacekeepers are also infiltrated by those same people.
It would be really nice. I don't know if we want to give the UN any credibility, but if the UN wants to have some credibility, having peacekeepers that can actually peace the keep is good. Peace the keep. Keep the peace. I'm being distracted. Is going to be a great step.
Yeah, we should. I don't know how you could entirely do that. I mean, you
That
could argue
stuff
you could
is proof we're not editing this too much. Pure.
yeah we could give the UN tanks for like their peacekeeping force, but I'm just not sure if that will really fly well. I
No,
mean,
you can only fit like two on a plane, anyways.
yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. I mean, you'd have to pass it through Russia, and if the United States proposes it, Russia won't pass it. But if someone like Iran or Russia proposes it, the United States won't pass it. They'll veto it.
Yeah, which along those lines, if you want to get into COP, I mean, that is kind of a problem we would have with these international conferences on climate change, is kind of a shifting away from these massive national players to smaller developing countries, just like how in our current political order, you can have the US or China veto anything on security. There's the same thing that people are really trying to shift power away from these massive developed countries to less developed countries in the most recent COP29. I don't think it's actually because the idea is these less developed countries are going to be hurting the most from climate change. That would be the ideal, to make sure the people that are hurting the most would get hurt the least. From what I'm seeing, a lot of these policies are actually just shifting money into like African countries out of guilt. I don't know if it's actually going to build up climate resiliency. Have you
Yeah,
heard about this?
the new plans of like giving a bunch of people loans.
Yeah, the jargon would be like financing climate resiliency.
Okay, I don't think so. At least not the most recent one, no.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, how crazy is it?
If you look at the kind of closing argument for COP29 on their website, it's phrased as this finance goal is an insurance policy for humanity. And the idea would be that they are tripling the amount of money being transferred to these developing countries to develop green energy projects. And I think we've kind of talked about this before. I think a lot of these loans are just going to become grants that are never paid back. You can try building these massive solar and wind networks in Africa, and I don't think it's going to end up being sustainable. What we have seen that has worked is taking smaller steps and saying this country gets a majority of its fuel from wood and biofuel. We are going to invest in their import terminals and give them oil. That's not a massive improvement, but it is a significant improvement. And it has, I don't know, it's something that Dan Crenshaw has said many times before. One of my favorite people to listen to, that just increasing the US exporting what is compared to coal and wood, one of the cleanest forms of energy, natural gas, to the rest of the world, really does help the developing world. Not because our renewable energy sources are bad, but they are very much still under work. They are not as efficient as we would like them to be right now.
Yeah.
I was rambling a bit.
Oh, that's good. So, okay. So basically, we're just going to give them a whole bunch of money to build things like wind turbines and solar panels. But the better idea would be to just have export American resources like natural gas. Because
Yes.
we have the money to build solar panels and things like Nevada or Arizona if we have to, and wind turbines. But African developing nations or wherever they are, don't.
And more than that, we have one, I trust the stability and success of projects in the US more than some grant the UN gave to Africa. And I trust more that the US is a very large country in which we can cite these things where it makes the most sense. There's a reason that Texas leads the nation in solar and wind, even if it's not a super, like what people think of as the environmental state, because it sits in a part of the US in which you can get great airflow, wind coming across the state, and constant sunshine.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you can't get that in Africa. I'm just saying we also have more of the infrastructure available.
Yeah, Texas is a pretty rich state and it has that geography. Wyoming actually is a developing state for wind energy.
And very undeveloped. We could get into this later, but just very undeveloped in terms of its potential.
Right. Yeah. It's one of the technically one of the poorest states in the country. And I do want to just quickly mention this. Usually when a state is poor in the United States, it's not because they're not focused on getting business headquarters headquartered in the state. It's because their potential, they haven't really been focusing on what their potential is. Like Wyoming, for example, they have an enormous amount of laws that restrict wind turbines. I mean, places like California and New York have laws that try to, I don't know what the word is, but basically place wind turbines by force in different places. Wyoming has the exact opposite. They're trying to ban a private company, which might be using 100% of its own funds from going to a farmer, buying a section of their land, and just building a wind turbine, which is, I mean, I think they're ugly,
Yeah.
but that's 100% legal and fine, especially if you're using your own money.
So I guess this is where we're trying to make this argument that is a way to do climate Christian stewardship, which is pro-growth, pro-human, and biblical, that we should be putting forward. And that we can't just cede the argument on climate to people that are kind of radical, woke socialists, which honestly, if you look at the language on many of these things, it's like sensible policies just wrapped up in socialistic language. We can pioneer some of these policies, but we can kind of take credit for the good things while throwing out the socialist garbage. And I think now that like these climate policies were so absent on the campaign trail this year, because I think the left really has been on the back foot. I think if there's any time that we reclaim the argument, it's going to be now. So yeah, we could talk about some ways in which we can be pro-environment without also hurting people in the process.
That's something that I've kind of been sort of into. Not, I mean, I'm not nearly as into the climate stuff as you are, but when it comes to like which side is correct and how you protect the environment and things like that, that's some sort of something I was back and forth on when I was first getting into politics. And it's really interesting, and I think it's incredibly important because if you do it wrong, whether you're on the far right or the far left, doesn't matter which far side you take. If you take one of those sides and hypothetically you're dictator of the world, that can end disastrously. You have to recognize that, yeah, I mean, climate changes, right? We can argue about whether or not it's because carbon emissions, but we should also acknowledge that it is in fact changing, and there are things we can do to, at the very least, not necessarily stop it, which maybe in some very few cases, I believe there could be, but more like, how do we just adapt to it? If
Yeah.
that makes sense, yeah.
No, it does make sense. And climate adaptation, I think, is the name of the game here. I think even some of the most radical environmental people will admit that we've reached a point where we're not just going to reverse the effects that humans have had on the climate. A big part of the game now is how do we live in this world? I think that's always been the game. We just need to admit it. I think the first step is looking at the usage of coal in the US because it is the dirtiest fuel. Coal is essentially pure carbon. And when you burn that carbon, you get a lot of carbon dioxide as well as some other heavy metals. And I think because it does make up a significant but small only 10% portion of our energy mix, this is something that we can feasibly phase out within the next generation. How
Yeah.
do you think that is?
I think that's actually incredibly feasible. I mean, we live in the United States, which has an enormous amount of resources, especially natural gas in North Dakota, Texas, and I don't know where all of our natural gas, whatever you call them, are, but we have quite a few of them, right? And so I think it's very feasible to, at the very least, replace it with something like water vapor. Or not water vapor. I'm reading this down on water vapor while saying this. Okay. Replace it with, we're gonna burn water vapor. Replace it with natural gas, right? And then you
Yeah.
can replace the natural gas that you used to replace coal with something like nuclear or something like that. And it just could be a whole chain, right? And in that sense, you can completely get rid of coal. And in the United States, that's very feasible.
No, totally. That there's kind of a scale of the most emitting and least emitting things, sources of energy. And I don't think we exactly need to make emissions the gold standard because I don't think the world is going to turn into a fireball once we reach a certain amount of carbon in the atmosphere. But there are harmful effects such as smog that do come from emissions, also. So it's still nice to have sources of energy that produce just steam. And like with, nuclear energy, though that it does produce a little bit of byproduct.
Yeah.
We can probably get, at least right now, we get like 70% of our energy mix from oil and gas. And I think Canada produces so much oil also, but they really are starved for energy infrastructure. If we can also help Canada out with approving these pipelines, approving new refineries that can service Canadian oil, because it really is quite low grade oil that needs a lot of refining, we could really do a lot there.
Yeah, and by the looks of it, that Pierre guy is going to get into office in Canada next year, and I really think the Trump administration will be able to do quite a lot of good with dealing with the Canadians with trade deals to make sure that they have their oil refined and things like that. Yeah, I think that would be very feasible, and we could, in my opinion, we should do the same with Mexico too, except Mexico's will be harder because they're way less developed than Canada and the rest of Europe.
Yeah, I mean, Mexico used to be a significant producer of oil. I don't know what happened to them.
I, in my opinion, they just kind of had a political breakdown. I don't think their politics were ever very good,
No.
but I think when the, well, I actually don't know if I don't have a stat on this, but my opinion is that the cartels don't directly control the government, but they control, I mean, some things that of what it does. And when they had this sort of political fallout, there wasn't any politician to sort of hand out money to oil companies, and it just wasn't feasible to do business there anymore.
And companies, if anything, desire stability. They desire some guarantee that their investments are safe. So a country
Yeah.
in that unstable really does hurt production.
Yeah, especially oil companies. I mean, Biden was just talking, not just, but like 2 years ago. He was talking about how we need oil for another 10 years at least, but there's all of these oil companies that are shutting down their oil rigs. And the reason why they're doing that is because of what Biden was saying. Biden was trying to comfort oil companies by saying we need oil for the next 10 years. But in reality, that's kind of alarming. Because if you go to a company, you're like, oh yeah, you're great for the next 10 years. But after that, not so much. I mean,
Yeah.
it's
And
not
I,
great.
to speak with some assurance to American corporations and saying, we're not about to destroy you. That's important. Also, a lot of these corporations have already agreed to some, in many cases, some pretty good standards on, like, we don't want cars emitting more than this amount in parts per million of carbon dioxide and sulfur. And I think I don't know how costly it is to change the exhaust of a car, so then that works. But it has been pretty effective, and like American cities are much less polluted than they were before.
Yeah.
So there's certain things in terms of emission standards that we shouldn't be hasty to be like, this is woke garbage, we got to get rid of it.
Yeah, emission standards are kind of like it's like a love-hate relationship, you know? They exist and they make cities clean and that's amazing and that's why they should exist. In fact, that's what I think this whole climate movement when it comes to cars is missing. Cars are not, in my opinion, are not causing the world to heat up and whatever else, the sea levels to rise or anything like that. It's not because cars exist or because it, whatever they're emitting. Car emissions do make cities dirty, though, and for that reason, we should
Yeah.
figure out a way to make sure that cities don't get full of smog and people don't die from illnesses thanks to these emissions. So for something like that, yeah, it makes total complete sense. We're trying to actually save people's lives, and you can actually visibly see the impact of it.
I think the majority of emissions would be from like power plants or homes that are usually heated by power plants or industrial applications. But that's just from what I remember.
Yeah, I think that would be right for CO2 emissions, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's how, I think that's right. It's mostly power plants, factories, or homes, or something like that. Yeah.
So, yeah, with the Trump administration, Lee Zeldin for the EPA, I haven't heard a lot about him. Do you think he's going to be good?
That depends. Okay, so. Oh dear. What did I give him when we were rating all the cabinet members? Like an 8 out of 10, I think. We'll see. We'll see if that holds.
Out of tens.
Yeah. So Right now, I would give him like a well, I'll just say I'll stick with an 8 out of 10. We'll see how it does, but I think he's gonna be okay. So, in my opinion, right now we're overregulating when it comes to climate, and I don't think he's going to cut too many regulations. Like, we need to cut regulations. We're kind of putting our country in a chokehold, and that's not a good thing. Like, we're putting in a chokehold so that we can't grow. We're not able to grow. We can't do what we actually need to do as a country. And so I think in that sense, he will be excellent. We'll just have to see if he cuts policies that are necessary. We'll see.
Yeah. And I mean, the one deregulation thing that I've heard the most about is these climate impact statements and how you can have any new building project be just wrapped up in red tape for like 3 years.
Yeah. But whatever happened with, I mean, this isn't super new. This is like 2001. Whatever happened with the Second World Trade, like they built the First World Trade Center, right? Again, like they rebuilt it. They
Yeah.
were supposedly supposed to build the second one, but it just doesn't exist.
What? I thought they built one on purpose because it was like the design had like eight sides. So it was like we have two buildings in one. Were they originally going to make two?
Let me look this up. I th thought I heard somewhere there were supposed to be two. According to Wikipedia, two World Trade Center, unfinished office building at the rebuilt World Trade Center in Manhattan, New York City.
Oh, man. And it was because of an environmental thing that kind of shut that down. That's
I'm not sure if it's environmental or just any other type of red tape. I don't know, but there's something that's holding it up.
Well, just in that whole vein, I think in order to get a proper, I don't know, green energy mix in the United States, that goes hand in hand with a more yes in my backyard deregulation approach. Where, I don't know, even in the trade-off between like this is a place that there's a certain place along a river that would obviously make a good spot for hydroelectric power, but it's going to ruin the view and put some trees underwater. I think we should have enough of a deregul or even that's not so much the case in America as it is an existing dam. People want to knock down, saying, no, we are going to choose to build and repair instead of taking the easy way out and pursuing this degrowth mindset. I think that's a big thing we need to hold on to.
Yeah, with like building and maintaining more hydroelectric dams, you mean?
Yeah. And
Yeah.
build, I mean, because I think you could even see this on the right a little bit where. In pursuing it, where we choose to give ourselves less energy because of some pretty marginal concerns. When we're talking about windmills hitting eagles out of the sky, I haven't seen anything that would show that that's killing more than a very small number of not very bright birds. I'm open to someone refuting me there, but I think if we say we're going to tear down our windmills because they hit a few birds, we're choosing to remove a massive amount of our energy production for something that's very marginal.
Yeah. Obviously, I'm not like against wind turbines in the sense like I don't want them to be illegal or anything like that, but my opinion is just don't subsidize them.
Yeah.
If I mean if some the way Iowa does it is we like each county sort of has their own little, it's not a company, but relatively like a company that builds the power plants and things like that. And there are some counties in Iowa that have a private company build up wind turbines, and that's totally fine. But I don't think the federal government should be paying for that. If the state government wants to subsidize it, whatever. But the federal government's goal is not necessarily to do that.
And between wind and solar is the one that I think is more efficient and profitable. Especially because you can build solar. I mean, you can build wind farms in less high value areas, but there are so many vast stretches of desert in the US that are perfect for solar, not in the same way where we're putting these massive wind farms on the most prime agricultural land in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, solar is pretty effective. I think right now it's 20 or 30% efficient, I think. I thought I saw something about that somewhere. I'll have to look it up sometime, but they're pretty efficient. They're more efficient than wind turbines, last I heard.
And wind turbines have more problems with them with the, I think we mentioned this before, but how their blades, they're massive, but you can't really recycle them.
Yeah.
They're made out of some sort of polymer where it just doesn't work out.
They are non-biodegradable. It's like there's apparently golf balls that are biodegradable now. So if you hit them into like the course and you lose it, you don't have to worry about it. But yeah, these wind turbine blades are not biodegradable. If you lose it, that's kind of on you.
And so things, problems like that, or with batteries that aren't very efficient right now, I think American renewables will become more efficient over time. And I think that's something to embrace. But at the same time, we have this massive wealth of other things that we should not ignore. We should have like all of the above approach where we're not explicitly building up any industry at the cost of others, and we're not certainly not trying to cut back on an industry.
Absolutely, yeah. I like Trump's entire idea of pro growth, and
Sure.
I just want to make sure he does it right. You know, I mean, who am I to say that he's doing it right? He's the president. I'm a citizen, but I mean, we're in America. We're in representative democracy. I can have my opinions. So.
What I think might be the most controversial of the obviously pro-growth things you could do is privatizing Western lands, that a great portion of the American West is government land that's either tied up in national parks or used for the own government's private purposes, or is just kind of sitting around there as like a trust. This land could be opened up for new cities to the West is very underpopulated, to build more places for people to live. There's a lot of districts that would be great for mining and natural resources, places for ranching. But at the same time, there are incredibly valuable national parks that are a core part of our heritage and some species like the wolves and buffaloes that we want to protect from becoming extinct. So, yeah, how do we go about this? Because it would be really amazing to not have the US be so unbalanced where we have these Western states that are practically empty. I think that goes against the command to be fruitful and multiply and spread over the whole earth. But this is also a very beautiful part that we don't want to ruin.
Yeah, I 100% agree. So I'm trying to find a detailed map. Okay, here we go. A detailed map of US national parks. There's as you were saying, there's quite a few of them, but there's also an enormous amount of federal land, or I don't know if it's federal, but land that's also here that's just open, unused, 100%. And a lot of that reason is because there's very little irrigation and not many rivers. So one of the reason why the Eastern United States is so populated compared to Western is because of the Mississippi River. It's just ginormous and it has branches that go throughout basically the entire eastern half. And when there isn't a branch that goes through it, there's some other river that connects to the Atlantic that does.
Yeah.
So the entire eastern half of the United States lives less than like 100 miles of a water source that leads you to the ocean, which is ridiculous. But then on the western half, where you get like California and Nevada and Utah and whatnot, it's way more dry and there's way more mountainous. And this is where I think the United States has sort of lost its innovation. Actually, the whole world in general. Many nations like the United States and Europe, when they were still developing, they would actually just irrigate and find ways to inhabit that land and make it a prosperous state. But we
Yeah.
don't do that anymore.
And if you look at examples across the world where we have, like, it is very possible to turn a desert into a paradise. You can kind of see that in California or
Yeah.
even in the irrigation projects done in Israel or, I mean, throughout many other of the more wealthy desert countries. It's possible with the right technology. You can pipe water from more distant sources. You can use even desalination plants. Water is a serious obstacle towards settling the West, but it's not like it's impossible. I guess the question still is like, what about people that are worried about like the West losing its charm?
Yeah, so I guess my question would be, what in the world is this charm? Because I haven't found it yet. I've been
Of
to be
ugly
com
desert.
to be completely fair, I've been in the Western United States once, and that was in California. So I don't have, top of the line experience from there. But I mean, okay, so when you're making the land more inhabitable, is it really losing its charm? Because what you're doing is you're making it so you can grow things there, more people can live there. You're kind of fulfilling God's command, and that isn't making anything lose its charm, it's adding to it. That's my opinion, but
Yeah, I think I've driven through the West quite a bit, and I think you could say that the worst that human civilization has to offer is more ugly than pristine nature. But a properly ordered, flourishing town, or maybe that's giving it too much credit, but just the average American city is more beautiful than pristine nature, in my opinion. And to develop and turn land into something useful that people benefit from is beautiful in itself.
there's something just remarkable about it. I mean, I was talking about this earlier in the day. So European and Asian cities, they built up instead of out, right? And to me, that's just horrific. Like, why would you do that? You just got these stories of skyscrapers, like 40 stories high. Everyone lives in the skyscraper somewhere. And I was driving through Sioux Falls. And Sioux Falls doesn't really have skyscrapers. There's some tall buildings, but they're not skyscrapers. But the city is very large. Like, it spans across South Dakota, a little bit of Nebraska. No, not Nebraska, a little bit of Iowa, and a little bit of Minnesota. That's just ridiculous. But the city is beautiful. Like, it has parks, it's got nature and everything.
It's very much the size of the US has enabled us to have this significant urban sprawl.
A lot of people talk bad about urban sprawl and say it's not good for the environment or something like that. Okay, in my opinion, the only people who say urban sprawl is bad for the environment are the people who think that there shouldn't be cities or almost even humans in existence at all, which is just ridiculous. But urban sprawl is technically good. I
Well,
mean,
it's good when it's for a purpose. When you
right.
have, it is very possible to have cities in which we kind of trap ourselves in a box where the city is so spread out, then I don't know, it's kind of like a fire. If you mesh everything together and it can't breathe, then the fire is not efficient at all, and it's just smoke. But if you spread it out among the whole, like, not the whole forest, but if you really spread out the fire, then it won't burn at all. I
Right.
think the efficiency of our public services and, like, the cohesiveness of social life is hurt a little bit by having, it's not good for people to be alone. It's good to have some sort of cohesiveness to a city. But that doesn't mean that like suburban life is evil. That
No.
things are very different. It
Right.
just that like there's no virtue to having communities separated by a mile long stretch of highway, and that's the way to go about it.
Yeah, I think the way America does suburban sprawl now is mostly okay, with some exceptions. I mean, there's obviously some times where it's not cool, but it's mostly okay, I would say. And I think altogether, so with America environmentalism and how we're using our land now, I think we're really getting to the right place. Even with under Biden, I think we're going to get there eventually. But with the way the American public is, we're not so much focused on, okay, well, we can't have as many cows because they fart too much or something like that. And we're really starting to focus more on stewardship, which is like, okay, we need to keep the air clean, keep the water clean. I mean, yes, nature is good, but we also need to build on top of nature and sometimes
Yeah.
things like that.
We're not going to talk about how we're offending Mother Earth by and how like any sort of development is ravishing her. That's not the way we view the world.
We're ravishing Mother Earth.
And no, and you'll legitimately find that kind of stuff in some of these reading through the COP report when they're talking about how like indigenous communities would say that this is an assault to Mother Earth. And it's like, no, we respect the earth, but the earth is not our God.
Right. Yeah. The Earth is a great, would you call it a gift from God, the Earth? Or would
Yeah.
you say it's more part of, like, we're one in the same, not one in the same, but like we're all part of the same?
Yeah, I'd say it's a gift in the sense that if you're given a gift, you're not expected to just like immediately smash it and be like, wow, what a crappy gift. Look at how special it is. Like, they're expected to use the gift in the way it was intended to be used.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, I'll call it a gift then. It's a gift from God, and we can use it, you know, kind of like when you get a normal gift, you can use it, but you also have to maintain it and take care of it and make sure it stays nice.
Yeah, that's a I like that analogy.
Yeah, so that, I mean, that was a very fast wrap up. Wow. Okay. So
Yeah, we in a very simple way, we covered a lot of what hopefully we see the future conservative environmental policy to look like. And it'll be really exciting to see what the Trump administration does, but even moving on from that with like a more conservative government in Canada, just worldwide, how do we deal with this?
right. Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see what the COP 30 or whatever it is next, what they do. And I really, well, during Trump's four-year term, we should definitely talk about each event that is environmentally re related that he does, whether it's pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement or whether he does something strange at a COP meeting. I don't know. We'll have to see.
Yeah.
But yeah, it'll be a fun ride.
On a less fun note, I think it would be good if maybe we could, not the entire episode next week, but talk about it a little bit next week of Britain's new law on assisted suicide. And it's a really brutal looking piece of legislation that opens the door to doctors being able to kill their patients.
Yeah.
The uncharitable way of looking at it. Of course, they'll put it as a way of like people suffering pain at the end of life. We're going to just let them go and give them their own decision. But I think looking into how that issue fits into a larger pro-life narrative, yeah, that's something we could do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this pro-life movement I thought was starting to win in Europe because a lot of European nations have, you know, some sort of abortion ban, like 15 weeks or something like that. And, you know, that's a good start. It's nowhere near where I want it to be. It's a good start, though. And then this happens with this euthanasia in Switzerland and in England and in Canada. It's just getting ridiculous.
Yeah. No, and Canada is so much worse than what Britain is bringing about right now. And that's everyone's fear is that it's going to be a slippery slope and Britain's going to become like Canada. Because right there, we shouldn't get it off in too much of a tangent, but they're like it's 5% of the population is dying of medical assistance and dying.
Yeah.
It's like the preferred choice for doctors, it seems.
Yeah, no kidding. There's this, I mean, kind of hilarious, but also sadly true meme. It's like, if you need stitches, well, in the United States, it's going to cost you $67,000. And then in Britain, it's going to take you 67 weeks to get the stitches. And in Canada, it's just like, well, have you considered dying yet? It's funny, but it's sadly true. It's kind of ridiculous.
It's such a dystopian thing.
Yeah. Well, let's hope I never know how to say his name, so I'm going to butcher it again. Pierre Poilievre, however you say that, he's French. Let's hope he wins, and I think he will, and by a very decisive margin, and he can get rid of some of this stuff.
I would love to see it.
Absolutely. Well, I think that is everything we had on our agenda for today. So next week we'll talk about Britain's euthanasia and euthanasia as a whole, and how this fits into the pro-life movement, and where the conservative pro-life movement should stand at as Christians today. Yeah, thank you guys for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week. Adios.